Hello, everybody. Everybody okay? Got to get started again. Well, that worked. Hey! Earl, sit down. Our next speaker is Roanne Siegel, member of the class of 87. Roanne is presently in Ottawa and is a medical oncologist specifically working with breast cancer. She is the medical lead for the breast cancer site group in Ottawa and is the director of the survivorship program. And her specific area of interest is in rehabilitation oncology. So we're, I think, essentially going to hear about how exercise is good and how it's particularly good and attainable for people who have been diagnosed with cancer and are recovering from treatment of such. Roanne is still married to the same guy with less hair. I'm not sure how that happens. And has, I think she has the three smartest kids from the class. She has one in her third year at medicine at Toronto, one in her third year of neurobiology at Harvard, and Jonah is starting science at McMaster's, so she's doing quite well. And she wanted me to brag about her children, so that's okay. So, Roanne, without further ado.
It's actually quite interesting to come home. And for the record, there's nothing wrong with Hugo Boss. Okay, I may be a shopaholic. That's my only disclosure. So this is daughter number two, actually, and what I'm really going to speak about today is exercise. She is. She can I really brag? She won the NCAA championship last year for GS. Where's my hubby? He's here somewhere. So what I'm going to be speaking about is exercise and enhancing health outcomes for patients, particularly with breast and prostate cancer. Just given the time limitations, we're going to go there. Before I do that, I think we have to do a little bit about biology 101, because the context of the exercise needs to be understood, I think, and grounded in what we do. So there is no question that early detection has really resulted in us being able to cure many patients, and that's the good news with over about 1 million survivors here in Canada, tenfold that in the U.S. and about 1 million in Australia. The bad news, if you will, and our next challenge is to address all the issues that these men and women subsequently have to live with, which includes the disease and the risk of progression, the risk for recurrent disease, as I said, chronic diseases, which we tend to accelerate by virtue of our recommendations, and of course, persistent and late effects, as well as quality of life. And so as a reminder, Biology 101, the reason we are able to be here is that we can replicate with fidelity cell for cell. What happens is when you lose fidelity, you lose the ability to create that same cell and you lose genetic stability. Ultimately, that leads to a diagnosis called cancer. Well, it's not that one cell that's the problem. It's the fact that the cells become autonomous, lose programmed cell death, or what we call apoptosis, and take on a life of their own. And it's ultimately the worst of the worst, the bad guys that break away from the initial tumor cell, travel either through the vascular or lymphatic system, and set up shop. And clearly these are the most aggressive, independent, and highly challenging to treat clones. This is the picture of our basic concept in terms of treatment. What the blue line represents is the cytotoxic kill with a certain chemotherapy regime, whatever we're talking about. We then have to give the patient a little bit of time to recover from the known side effects, but unfortunately we're given the cancer time to recover as well. But the best outcome is when we stick to dose and schedule. If we are nice, if we kind of try and cut them some slack, if you will, allow them to recover. Of course, we allow the cancer to recover, and we get inferior outcomes. And it's so these principles that we stick to, in other words, we are the most aggressive of the most aggressive because it gives you the best outcome. So that's cancer and cancer therapeutics in general. What about breast cancer? We are quite lucky here in Canada, and this is quite distinct from the third world, that the majority of patients really do present with early stage disease. The majority are self-detected, physical exam or screening mammography. With this, the initial impact in terms of our recommendations will be for a surgical approach, usually breast conserving surgery, sentinel node, axillary node dissection, followed by radiotherapy. And those are, again, the leading sort of consequences on the local regional edge. We then turn to the systemic therapy and why everyone hates coming to see me. And we're talking about systemic therapy, chemo, hormones, targeted agents. The therapies are getting much more complex and are based on all of these characteristics. While you might think hormonal therapy is easy and is the way out, the consequences for the woman are dramatic. There's weight gain, there's change in body composition, usually a shift from muscle to fat. And this has important consequences, never mind on body image, psychological wellness, but also in the context of there's growing and mounting evidence that I'll show you that weight gain, particularly in the postmenopausal woman, leads to adverse outcomes for breast cancer as well as cardiovascular, diabetes, and the like. There are new and many new targeted agents. I show you one here called Herceptin. Again, we've revolutionized the treatment of what we call HER2-positive breast cancer, but the problem is this causes a whole host of cardiovascular concerns. And then we have an alphabet soup of chemotherapy agents that bring about a variety of side effects, cardiovascular, taxane-based, neuropathy, and the like. And so we are aggressive. We are delivering treatment now that goes up to a year and a half in terms of the intravenous form, another 5 to 10 years of hormonal therapy. So as I said, the good news is we're saving patients. The challenging news is these women have to live with them. So this is daughter number two, who's a triathlete and really is a superwoman. And this is where my research starts. So this is what we started about 15 years ago when I took up this kind of approach. And what I said is I am going to start exercising these women right from the get-go. Our research ethics board had seizures. We had to negotiate the protocols. My colleague said, you are completely nuts. They will never come. They will never do it. It's not going to happen. And furthermore, the standard recommendation was, if you're tired, rest. So we went against dogma. And what we developed was an intervention. This represents early stage breast cancer. And sorry, I'm getting the hang of this. And what we did is, whether they were on chemotherapy or hormonal therapy, we randomized them into a supervised, what we call aerobic, which is usually a walking-based exercise intervention, at a very modest intensity, 65%, which would be the equivalent of you walking down the street, maybe a little breathless. We had to get it by ethics. We had to meet all their criteria. So they were randomized to what we call supervised, self-directed, or weightless control, which is our way of saying do what you want, no direction. And the incredible outcome, not for me or for I think anybody who really believed in exercise, but for the naysays in our group, was the fact that the women came, there were no adverse effects, and in fact we improved outcome in both the self-directed and the supervised exercise group. I will also draw your attention to the fact that the women who did not exercise, they didn't stay static, they declined in their quality of life. And this is a recurring theme you're going to see with all the trials I show you. In the control group, in the group that did nothing, there was a decrement in whatever we were measuring. So we got a little more gutsy when we went to trial number two. We called it the START trial. This time, again, it's early stage breast cancer, but the ante is going up. We're now going from our cardiac toxic drug to our cardiac toxic drug and our neurotoxic drug. And again, what we did is said we're going to up the ante in terms of the dose and the amount of exercise for your aerobic. Now it's more of a, I'm going to really exercise and get you like jogging. The resistance is weight training. And again, we went against that dogma of you can't lift because you'll get lymphedema, and again, our usual care. And our usual care at this point was not blocking whatever exercise these women wanted to do, because in our center, it was well known that exercise was becoming a valuable modality. Unfortunately, this trial did not reach statistical significance in the outcome, which was a number of quality of life outcomes, but all the quality of life outcomes we did measure trended in that positive direction. And again, remember, we're giving these women really toxic chemotherapy, and I think this is part of it, and we learned in terms of these were quality of life assessments that we were taking. We did objectively look at peak oxygen consumption, actual strength, we call this lower and upper body fitness, and a number of body composition measures, and those were statistically significant, showing that, again, these hard outcomes could be an improved quality of life, a little bit more of a challenge. We've just completed our third trial and submitted for publication, so I got to say stay tuned. Now, as I sort of alluded to, the therapies are getting more and more complex and long, and now we're getting our anthracyclines, our taxanes, and this monoclonal called Herceptin, which adds a further complexity and another year of therapy. And this time it was, well, would a combined amount be better in terms of whatever outcome we're looking at? A regular or a high intensity volume. And without, you know, divulging before we get the publication out, there is no question we are seeing positive outcomes here. And so we have now written guidelines in Canada, in the US, that come out and basically say it is safe to exercise while you're on adjuvant chemotherapy of whatever recipe we throw at you, that you can do it, we can improve your strength, we can improve your aerobic capacity. Quality of life, I guess it depends on what we're suggesting and how you define quality of life, a little bit of a softer outcome, and body composition, a little bit more of a challenge. Well, what about post-treatment? In other words, our definition of post-treatment is after you've completed the intravenous chemo and targeted agents. Many of these women are still on these hormonal agents, which I alluded to have toxicity that is real. And real is outlined here in terms we have mounting evidence that obesity, low levels of physical activity, and high fat intake are adverse factors in terms of you having either recurrent breast cancer, death from your breast cancer, or even getting your breast cancer. And this is a meta-analysis, and we're in there somewhere showing all the trials that show a negative impact in terms of body weight, and here a negative impact in terms of if you are physically inactive, less than 3 met hours per week versus 9, and 9 would be a reasonable amount of moderate to intense exercise, your probability of mortality is literally threefold. And so we have this evidence that we can present to patients in terms of their breast cancer specific outcomes. We also have this unfortunate graph, which is a problem not only in Canada but in the US, and this is Pam Goodwin's work, whom we're collaborating with, that shows these are women who are underweight, and here's your risk of breast cancer. Here's, if you will, ideal body weight. 27 BMI is probably the upper limit of ideal body weight, with 30 being obese. And you can see what happens to this curve as we get more and more obese. And I don't know what proportion of women are obese in Canada. We're probably up and catching the U.S., but it's literally growing, and our young men and women are also becoming more and more overweight and obese. And this shows you, again, the risk of recurrence and the risk of death goes up, as does your insulin levels, suggesting that this might be a mechanism for this. The hypothesis here, which I think is really interesting, and I threw in just because I thought this was an academic talk. What did I know? So this is your metabolic pathway. This is what you want for gluconeogenesis and glucose metabolism. But here's our mitogenic pathway. And what we think is that there are receptors on the breast cancer cell. And for insulin receptors to be active, they must dimerize. And the most common form of dimerization in the breast cancer is this fetal dimerization. And what happens is it then allows ligand binding of your typical insulin, but also insulin-like growth factor, as well as a whole bunch of other factors that stimulate preferentially this mitogenic pathway versus this metabolic pathway. And if this is sitting on your breast cancer cell, hence may be the explanation of why we get recurrence and death. So what we did is incorporate these two factors into our latest trial, which is called LISA, which is a lifestyle intervention. And these are women, again, early stage breast cancer. They finished their chemotherapy, but they're on a hormone called Femara. You were allowed into this trial if you had at least a BMI of 24, so we didn't want the underweight women, but we stratified you between 24 and 30, or obese, which we defined as over 30. And we gave you what we call this educational intervention, which is here's a whole bunch of information. We didn't tell you what to do, which we know is tantamount to a control arm, because people will just not do anything unless you literally walk them through it, versus what we called our weight loss intervention. And there were three goals of this program, with the primary outcome being what we call disease-specific breast cancer survival. We don't have that, but I'll show you what we do have as of now. There was a 10% weight loss if you were overweight. This is through caloric restriction by cutting down your fat intake, and we got you moving at 150 to 200 minutes of walking per week. This was a cross-Canada U.S. international collaborative study that we ran. It was a remote delivery through a call center by highly trained individuals with master's, PhD level training in either psychology, psychiatry. We had one coach, nutrition, physical activity. So these were extremely educated women and men delivering this intervention and coaching these women to it, through it. What the program was a two-year, as I said, remote access delivery of calls made to these women to give them the information and coach them through this in terms of getting going, as many of these are postmenopausal sedentary women who are overweight, unfortunately. And you can see we have an intense phase, a consolidation phase, and a maintenance phase. And our initial outcomes are shown here. This is after about 230 patients. Not all of them have reached the target 18 months that we are completing. But what we first did is said, okay, would these women either stick with the program? And so we counted the proportion of women that actually completed their calls at these time points. And the number that met the target amount of physical activity, the dietary restriction, and the weight loss that we wanted them to, which was a pound to two per week. And what you can see here is on the weight loss intervention arm, there's a mean loss of 5.6 kilograms at 6 months, 5.9 at 12 months, and 6 kilograms at 18 months. And this is a huge amount of weight for postmenopausal women. This is not an easy thing to do. This is contrasted with about 1.4 maximum weight loss in the what we call, you know, control arm group. Remember, anyone that's going into this is highly motivated, so this does not represent the general population. The general population gains a mean of 3 to 6 kilograms. This is, you know, non-selected. So this is another way of graphically showing you those results, and what we see here is this is the top group that did not receive, this is our control group, either the BMI between 24 and 30 or even the more obese. Clearly, those that were obese or not lost weight if they were on the what we call weight loss intervention arm. And this one separates it whether you received chemotherapy up front or not, because we know it's much tougher to lose weight after you've received chemotherapy, and nevertheless, they still did. This is our quality of life data that shows your quality of life is superior on our intervention arm, even though we're making you exercise and making you diet. And finally, in this group, it's the women clearly met their exercise targets at all points up to 18 months. These are contrasted against the individuals we said, here, this is what we want you to do, but gave you no direction. So I'm going to do in my last couple of minutes a couple words about our prostate cancer trials. I know I'm a little bit close to time, but again, this is a very common disease as well, 25,000 men, and the majority of these, unfortunately, are going on to have metastatic disease of some sort or another because we're getting better at curing them of their other problems. That's the problem in prostate cancer as well. This is what we do for early stage disease, surgery followed by radiation. But in advanced disease, it's called total androgen blockade, androgen suppression, a number of names for it. But clearly, we render that gentleman castrate, and then we send him to our colleagues for psychological intervention. Bottom line is, the trials here, different than breast cancer, are done in what we call this metastatic setting, hormone sensitive and locally advanced. So breast cancer trials are being done in the early stage disease. This is being done in the advanced stage disease. And the reason is because these are the changes that happen on these hormone therapies. So again, it's not chemo, so people would say not a problem. It's a huge problem. These men gain fat mass. They lose. They gain body weight of about 2.4%. They lose lean body mass. And what's critical here is the average age of this man is 75 plus, and they're on this therapy for up to 10 years. And so when you take muscle mass away from a 70-year-old gentleman, this is critical. There's falls. There's all kinds of other problems that happen. And then you get this insulin resistance or metabolic syndrome and accelerated cardiovascular morbidity. So we did two trials looking at this, taking these men who are on what we call androgen suppressive therapy, randomized them to a weight training program. And what you see here is that constant comment about if you do nothing, this is the total cohort, the fatigue is incredibly worsened. This is our scale, and this is a very clinically meaningful result. But if you intervene and get them to weightlift, and that's what we did, you have an improvement in your fatigue. What we did is we divided it, whether they were being treated with curative or palliative intent, long or short-term ADT. And the take-home message here is it works if you do it, doesn't matter what you start. But in addition, it also says that even if you get to that gentleman after years of ADT, you can still train them. Remember, these are men with castrate levels of testosterone, so this is quite a feat. We also correlated this to a hard physical outcome, which is strength, and that's the reason they feel less tired. Is you train them, they become stronger, and these are the changes you see again across the board. Our final trial that I'm going to show you is, again, a similar cohort receiving ADT on radiotherapy, and this time, again, we did similar to the breast cancer group. We looked at aerobic versus resistance versus usual care. And you see, again, a similar idea. Usual care, they get worse. If you train them with weights, they will improve. And in our aerobic group, again, at least we got them to hold their own. And so our take-home message from here is you've got to get people to exercise. You've got to get them to engage in something when we're treating you for cancer. If you don't like lifting weights, well, at least do this because it will definitely enhance outcomes. So in summary, what we've come out and said and what has now become standard of care accepted in both the U.S., Australia, as well as Canada, our summary guidelines that we've all written and say that exercise is safe for men and women receiving cancer therapy. We've had to come out and make this caution component that was part of what was mandated, particularly because we're bringing in the elderly male. We've made comments on aerobic capacity, muscular resistance, a number of body composition and quality of life outcomes. They are specific per cancer site in our guidelines, and we will guide you if you are receiving this therapy, what may be the best one to do. We've also come out and made comments about what we call now energy balance, promoting weight management for these men and women, as, again, there's data that he didn't show that shows outcome is inferior just about in all of the major tumor types if you either are going into it overweight or gain weight throughout it. So comments about exercise intensity, prudent diets are all built into these guidelines. And finally, we are now doing research looking at different biomarkers, seeing if we can look and see whether we can affect and or what is the driving force behind the exercise. We're not sure it's the exercise. It's probably the mediator of some marker. Thanks.